afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Toe Meets Leather podcast. I'm Logan, and do you hear this? That's the sound of a refreshing Coke Zero. I can't deny the deliciousness. Anyway, I'm here today with my good pals, Tommy, Andrew, and Nigel. Tommy, how you doing today?
Good. Drinking a delicious Dr. Pepper 10 over here. So much better than that Coke Zero.
Nigel, how are you doing all right? Nigel and Andrew still trying to figure out the mute buttons from last week. So, how are y'all doing?
Hey, I kind of...
Oh my God, I figured it out. God, it's so hard.
Are y'all doing okay?
Sweet tea, by the way.
Oh, okay. The traditional Southern drink. I can see from his camera that Andrew doesn't actually have anything.
I mean, I get a glass of water, you know, trying to be healthy and less fat and stuff.
It is the number one drink of America right now, believe it or not.
Water.
I refuse to accept it, though. Coke Zero for life.
That's just gonna be fat.
I'm like Dwight Howard now. I refuse to drink water. I'm just drinking soda and alcohol for the rest of my life. I don't care. All right. Anyway, this is a college football podcast. We'd like to remind everyone. So let's talk about some college football. Week two was way more exciting than I think any of us expected. We had some serious upsets. Central Michigan, of all people, with the proving that the Drumextral Michigans are out for blood right now, defeated Oklahoma State. Arkansas wiped out TCU in overtime. Nigel, you called that one. And plenty of other big games. I'd love to cover them all, but there's only so much we can talk about in the time we're given. Tommy, do you have any games you'd like to talk about from last weekend?
Yeah, so the game I wanted to highlight was the one I talked about before last week as actually living up to the hype I thought it would, Arizona State and Texas Tech. They did hold the record that week for the most points scored of any team or any game in Division I that does include the FCS. They scored a total of 123 points in a single game that did not go to overtime, and Arizona State won 68-55. There was over 1,200 yards of offense and over 55 first downs in that game. So just absolute 100% offense all the time. Lots of fun. And actually... Arizona State was pretty balanced. They about 56% of their yards were passing, and then 44 rushing. Texas Tech, on the other hand, pretty much 85% of their yards were passing. So just throw the ball everywhere, which is what they do anyway.
I mean, I would expect nothing less from the Big 12, man. No.
Yeah. So, but what we thought would happen happened. But that's not a bad thing. It was absolutely electric. Lots and lots of points, lots of yards, zero defense. While I don't like that to be every game I watch, watching at least one of those games a week would make me a happy man.
That's true. And Nigel, I think we're going to get to the big games, TCU and Arkansas, in a second. But do you have any particular matchups you'd like to highlight from the weekend?
Definitely Syracuse versus Louisville. I stayed up to watch that game. I was wondering maybe with a step up in competition, Lamar Jackson would have a couple of flaws exposed. I will admit he's definitely got to work on his throwing game a little bit more. There are a couple of wide open receivers that he definitely missed where, I mean, you could tell how raw he is as a passer of the football just because he was throwing against the grain. His man had a step on the outside and he threw it to the inside. So there's definitely some work to be done, but in terms of just pure athletic ability, you know, I mean, obviously with all the kind of pre-Heisman talk after 2 weeks is, you know, a little premature, but I think he's just, I mean, he's probably the most electric player in college football so far this season.
Yeah, so I was actually looking at a stat from earlier. I didn't realize this. Apparently Lamar Jackson, not Louisville, just Lamar Jackson, has scored more touchdowns than all but 13 teams in the NCAA right now. I think if the Heisman was given out in the month of September, he would have won it already. But sadly, that is not the case. Andrew, did you finally remember what game you wanted to talk about?
I did. I want to spend another week talking about the wonderful world of Academy football. Yet again, Navy, Air Force, and Army all walked away winners this week. The Air Force Falcons absolutely donkey stomped the Georgia State Panthers. Nate Romine, the quarterback, 20 carries, 124 yards, 6.2 per carry. You know, Georgia State's really missing the loss of Nick Arbuckle at quarterback. Connor Manning went 8 of 24 for 135 yards. That's 33% for those that didn't want to do the math at home. The Army got out to a big lead and then just kept it going, 31-14. Andy Davidson, the Army, back again, over 100 yards. That's two wins in a row for the embattled Jeff Munkin up at West Point. And the Navy actually had to fight and scrap against a UConn team. They had the lead at halftime and then gave up two quick scores in the third quarter, but then fought their way back. You know, same thing with Navy, running the ball, running the ball, running the ball. You know, it's great to see the academies be able to have this success and keep this rolling. We get the first part of the Commander-in-Chief Trophy, Navy at Air Force, on the 1st of October.
And that's going to be a big matchup to look forward to, especially those have been typically the two biggest programs of the academies. But Army's starting to look very good this year. I will say, Navy was actually one of the games I wanted to kind of touch on because that game was closer than it appeared. UConn had the ball on the one with 15 seconds left on the clock, no timeouts, ran, and they couldn't get into the end zone, and the clock ran out. And I think some people were complaining about it being gamesmanship on Navy's part, but I think if you're UConn in that situation, you got to make a play by either spiking it or throwing it out of the back of the end zone to give you some extra time to run another play. That's how it goes. You know, do what you got to do to win. The other game that I wanted to talk about with really bad time management was Washington State against Boise State. Washington State actually ruined one of my picks by their poor clock management. Boise State, for some reason, decided to heave the ball downfield and get intercepted in the end zone. So Washington State got the ball at the 20, and they actually had a time to make a drive. They had 53 seconds left on the clock, two timeouts left from their own 20. So plenty of time to make it downfield. They actually ran five plays, didn't call a timeout, let the clock run down to 4 seconds at their own 36-yard line, finally before calling a timeout. It was a bad scene. That really upset me in a lot of ways. But, you know, again, poor clock management kills. And Washington State's just proving more and more how overhyped they were kind of going into the season. It makes me a little disappointed. Anyway, let's get to the big matchups that everybody wants to talk about. So I'll start with Central Michigan and Oklahoma State. I've kind of got my own thoughts on that whole end-of-the-game scenario, but I'll go ahead and pass the ball off to Andrew. Do you want to start talking about this matchup?
I mean, the thing about it is you hate to see a game that ends that way on what has been obviously a referee's mistake, but then you really have to look at it, and I don't really feel a lot of sadness for Oklahoma State because you shouldn't be in that position. You shouldn't put yourself in a position where the officials can have such a huge impact on the game. They made a lot of mistakes, you know, and they let Central Michigan hang around and hang around and hang around. And, you know, finally they took the chance they had. And, you know, like I said, it sucks, but you just don't ever want to put yourself in that position. You know, huge shout out to Cooper Rush at Central Michigan, who put together a great game, 30 of 42, 361, four touchdowns, and only one interception. You know, I think the other thing that really bit Oklahoma State is their inability to run the ball again. I mean, they're awful on running the ball and severely one-dimensional, and it really kind of hurts them a lot more than you would think.
Yeah, that was kind of my thought process, actually, was if you're really ranked that high, they were expected to win by 3 touchdowns. They were, I forget the exact amount of points, but I believe it was 22. They were a 22-point favorite. And to be at home, to have that kind of advantage, to have more experience and all that, and to let yourself be in a position where the refs can make that kind of decision and ruin the game for you, that's on you, you know? Nigel, do you feel the same way?
I do. I mean, the thing that kind of stuck out to me the most was that neither of the coaches knew the rule. None of the refs on the field apparently knew the rule. So, I mean, I guess this is not something that commonly happens at the end of games. Obviously, we would have heard about it more often than not. And this just seems like one of those things that it'll be put in the book for the rest of the season. It'll be put in the book for next year in the training, and people will make sure this doesn't happen, you know, at least in the near future again. But I mean, we're condemning the refs for a rule that apparently no one knew. And I mean, really, we didn't find out it was down until later that evening, by the time the game had already been solidified and we had seen it on SportsCenter 4 or 5 times. So, you know, I agree with Andrew. They shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. You know, people didn't knock the ball down. Like, there was just, I mean, there's a lot of things Oklahoma State.
Yeah.
It was just a perfect storm. And I'm not going to cherry pick one thing. That's a human error. It's not a common instance that most people throw it out of bounds the last play, or the technically the thought to be last play of the game.
Yeah. And I think if you also think about it, like, by that same logic, the quarterback could have just tried to run for it and then gotten taken down, and the clock would have actually run out that way. But because he decided to throw it, nobody knew the rule, and that was how it played out. And I will agree, I don't think anybody knew until they got some of those serious, like, we've been around for a long time, refs, you know, that ESPN has finally commented on it. Tommy, do you feel any regret for Oklahoma State here?
No, and honestly, I don't think this has anything to do with either the teams on the field or the position or anything. I think there's a bigger discussion that needs to happen around officiating and the rule book as a whole. Because if you actually dive into the rule, and the rule that they were using is actually an addendum. It's an exception to a rule that says that the play or a game can end on a penalty if the penalty is committed by the team of possession, which would be the offense at that point. So in really the purpose of that is not for a team trying to run out the clock. The purpose of the rule is for a team that's on offense trying to make a drive, not committing a penalty just so they get another free play to get another shot at it. Because the actual rule itself is about if the defense commits a penalty on what would be the last play of the game, you give the offense another shot because that's fair. So I think if you actually go by the fairness of what should happen, I think the officials got it right in that way. By the letter of the rule book and the exception where it's explicitly printed, yes, they're wrong. Yes, they got suspended by 2 weeks by the MAC, which I applaud the MAC for actually calling their officials out. I'd like to see the Power 5 conferences do that more and say, hey, you're wrong, here's the deal, and you're suspended. I mean, look at what happened with the Miami touchdown last year and against Duke and that craziness. But I think there needs to be probably some more thought and, I guess, fringe testing on the rule book with scenarios like this that are weird that, you know, what State tried was not a bad idea, but you've got to realize if you're a coach, hey, let's not commit a penalty on our last play intentionally. I mean, clearly what they did was intentional grounding, 100% intentional too. So I think it has less to do with the actual specific game, and the story really needs to be focused more around the rule book as a whole and vetting some of those fringe testing.
And I want to give some credit to Central Michigan where it's due, because I've heard a lot about the complaint about the rule, but Central Michigan still had to make a Hail Mary pass and make an incredible play to get in that end zone, and they did it. I think they deserve that win every bit, despite the asterisks that might go be associated with it. Anyway, the next game, Arkansas and TCU is... I just like watching Arkansas. They're so crazy to watch sometimes. You see them get into these knockout, drag-out games with teams they really should be considered worse than. Nigel, you picked the outcome of that game correctly, so I'll go ahead and hand it over to you. What do you think stood out to you in that matchup? Mute is on.
For me, TCU's defense, I thought they had taken a step. I thought they were going to take a step forward this year. They were definitely more healthy than they had been pretty for the majority of all last year, just where they were, I mean, basically taking people out of the stands to fill their secondary and linebacking core. So I really thought that they would be able to take a step forward. And this year, you know, so far, they really haven't been able to stop the ball at all. And you know, where I thought against, South Dakota State, they would, you know, the ball was definitely thrown a little bit. It was a little bit more of a balanced team where they were throwing and running the ball. Where Arkansas, you know what they want to do. They want to run the ball. That's all they're going to do. They're going to try to put eight men in the box, and they're going to try to run it down your throat. And TCU should have had a more than enough time to game plan for that. And Arkansas established their will against TCU very handedly and basically dared them to stop the run, and they couldn't, not at all. So I'm not sure where TCU is going to end up this year. I thought they were going to be a contender in the Big 12, which I think you've definitely spoken to before, that the Big 12 is just kind of reeling right now with TCU having fallen out of the ranks this past week. So I don't know. I don't know what TCU needs to do because offensively I think they're fine. It's defensively some adjustments, which is surprising because that's Gary Patterson's forte.
All right. I was what I got out of the game was that it was a huge swing, though, because TCU really did start behind, but they picked it up in the second half. I mean, I wouldn't put it all against them. They did come on. I think they just came on a little too late and gave Arkansas the breathing room they needed to get ahead in the matchup. Tommy, let's go to you. What did you see was it about Arkansas or TCU in this matchup? Was it TCU being bad or Arkansas just coming out and dominating?
So a little bit of both. I wouldn't say Arkansas dominated. I mean, they scored 13 points in the first half, and then in the second half they scored 15 points. They gave up nothing in the first half, and then they gave up 28 points in the second half. So I think Arkansas is consistent, which is what they want to do. I think TCU really, and I get what Nigel's saying about their defense and everything, but I think their defense played all right. If you're TCU, you can't go an entire half of a football game and not score any points. That's not who TCU is, and they're not going to win very many games that way, even in the Big 12. You know, that there's only one or two teams in the Big 12 where they could pull a stunt like that and probably still be pretty confident in being able to pull off a win. So their offense needs to not have slow starts to the beginning of the game. They need to score every quarter like they can.
All right, Andrew. we're talking about the same game. How whole hog are you on now? Do you believe in Arkansas now?
You know, I'm still not really sold on them. You know, they definitely capitalized on turnovers. The pick six in the first half really helped them out. They were extremely efficient, you know, very well balanced on offense. They ran the ball. They threw the ball effectively. They didn't turn the ball over, which I think is one of the really big things that kind of tells me the story of the game was Arkansas didn't turn the ball over while TCU did. You know, and then if you go back, you know, Arkansas lost the turnover battle against Louisiana Tech and squeaked out a win, and the Louisiana Tech defense really shut them down. But you know, they were able to get back to what they wanted to do, which was run the ball, be efficient passing the ball, and they did just enough to win the game. You know, I think you play this game 10 times. I'm not sure I can say Arkansas would win it 5, but they won at the time that mattered.
And that's all that counts, yep. All right, well, this game did go to overtime. It was Arkansas's 5th overtime game in the past 3 years, and they have won every single one of those games that has not been played against Texas A&M. So, in honor of Arkansas's fun overtime games, because every one I've seen has been greatly enjoyable, some a shootout in one form or another, I'd like to take some time to talk about our favorite overtime games. Now, Tommy, I know you've done a great deal of research, so I'd like to go ahead and hand it over to you. Why don't you get us started off?
Yeah, so if you want to look at college football, kind of the history of overtime before we jump into some of the more fun games, there's only actually one team that has played an overtime game. And pretty predictably, it's UMass. You know, they're one of the more recent transfers in. Their first season was 2012, so they haven't played a lot. But still, they're the only team in the FBS that has never played an overtime game. Everybody who is either perfect or the opposite of perfect has only played one overtime game. So there's nobody who's only played 2 overtime games and lost or anything. They've either won or lost one game, or they're at least everybody's at least won and lost one if they've played at least 2 games. As far as the juggernauts all time, Tennessee and Arkansas are the 2 that have played the most overtime games with 18, and they are both 12-6. So you're looking at a 66% there. They did actually play each other once in overtime, and that was in 2002. That game went to 6 overtimes, and Tennessee actually won that game 41-38. So if you want to look at the all-time great at overtime, it's probably going to be Tennessee there with their 12-6 record overall. As far as I know, Logan, you've picked out a couple fun overtime games to take a look at. The one I want to highlight, though, is that in 2006, FIU and North Texas played a game that went to 7 overtimes, and the final score of that game was 22-25. So they played a lot of football and didn't score a lot of points. There were 2 touchdowns scored. Neither of those touchdowns, or there were 3 touchdowns scored, and only one of them actually counted for 7 points. They missed an extra point in one, and North Texas actually had to go for 2 to get it to the first overtime situation. Fun fact in there, Dennis Hopovac, the North Texas kicker, actually attempted 9 field goals, which is tied for the NCAA record, and he only made 5 of them. The long in that game was 42 yards, so it's not even like he was kicking super far all the time.
Oh, man.
Just a crazy game. Also, there was a safety in the first quarter, too. So as far as scoring oddities, this game has got to take the crown. It's also interesting to note that FIU went 0-6 that year, and North Texas went 2-4. So this was just every possible way this could be a bad game. It was.
I feel like that's a lot more enjoyable looking back than it probably was sitting through it for the FIU and North Texas crowd. One thing I want to touch on in case there's any NFL guys listening right now. One of the neat things about college football is overtimes can't end in a draw, unlike a lot of other sports. So one team has to come out on top and they keep going back and forth until that happens. Andrew, I know you've already got a pick in mind, so I'd like to go ahead and hand it over to you. If you can figure out how to unmute yourself.
Yes. So the game that I really want to focus on is, and it's an older game, and I actually remember watching this when I was in high school, is the 2000 Independence Bowl between Texas A&M and Mississippi State. This game is called the Snow Bowl. Due to a massive snowstorm in the Shreveport area before the game, that just dumped inches of snow on the field to the point that you could not see the hash marks. You had trouble seeing the yard line markers. On top of that, Mississippi State wore white uniforms and helmets. So at times, watching this game, you really couldn't tell what was going on. Someone would get tackled, and you couldn't tell if it was the snow or it was a player. It was actually a pretty good game. It was 20-14 at the half. You know, a really explosive fourth quarter. But you get to overtime. The first play from overtime, Texas A&M running back Jamar Toombs, who in the game ran for 193 yards and three touchdowns, broke loose and scored a touchdown on the first play. The next issue is, though, Mississippi State blocks the extra point. Eugene Clinton picks it up, laterals it to Julius Griffin, a defensive back, who runs all the way, takes it all the way back to score 2 points. So it's 41-37 going into the second overtime. Mississippi State scores on a broken play to win the game. Yeah, and it's just like I said, just one of the craziest games that I've ever seen. You know, the snow was insane. Most of the fans weren't, you know, they left at halftime. It was crazy.
Well, who would want to stay in those kind of conditions? But it's fun to see something like that, especially with the white jerseys where it's like, you know, guys, we'll just build a snowman just as a distraction. They'll never see it coming. Yeah, I love this. That's the kind of stuff I love to see about college football. Nigel, you've got any big overtime games you want to talk about? Is that a no, Nigel?
Unfortunately, I do not, especially when Tommy just gave us basically the entire history breakdown of overtime, except for the definition of overtime, which is awesome. So, no, I do not have a follow-up for what is the best overtime game, because unlike Andrew and Tommy, I have not watched as much college football, so I need to watch more overtime games. That's my one assignment for the rest of the season.
There's one more that I'd like to talk about, Logan, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
And that was the 2014 game between Virginia Tech and Wake Forest that I've heard referred to as the Moon Bowl.
Oh.
Because both of those teams went to overtime tied 0-0.
Yes.
Wake Forest kicker Mike Weaver missed 3 field goal attempts in regulation, including a 37-yarder as time expired, but he would make his 2 attempts in overtime to clinch a 6-3 win for the Demon Deacons over the Virginia Tech Hokies.
Wow. It's sad when it comes down to something like that.
And I do remember that because they got chastised. The ACC as a whole did get chastised for that whole game, even though I think Alabama and LSU played a very similar game. It didn't go to overtime, obviously, but they played a very similar game. So good. I do remember that one, Andrew. That's a good one.
There is a great picture of that one out there for anybody who's just Google Moon Bowl Frank Beamer, and it shows the 0-0 final score with Frank Beamer celebrating, pumping his fists in the air.
I mean, when I think of the Moon Bowl, I think of Michigan versus Northwestern going 0-0. But yes, that one's a good one as well. I like that. So since no one brought it up, I want to talk about what is possibly, in my mind, it's the game that got me really into college football, and it's probably one of the most exciting games in football history, you know, if not just the most exciting, which was the 2007 Fiesta Bowl, which was Boise State versus Oklahoma. And there's a lot of backstory that has to go behind this. You know, Boise State going undefeated, they weren't a very well-reputed team. This was like the first year that they did very well for themselves and were trying to tout themselves as a big program. And, of course, Oklahoma's a powerhouse out of the Big 12. The game went back and forth the entire time. Let's see. And I think though, what everybody remembers from that game is that at the end of the fourth quarter, Boise State needed to score, and they ended up going for a hook and ladder play, which is so rarely seen in football. It's when a receiver grabs the ball downfield in a crossing route and then tosses it back to another receiver who's doing a crossing route. And that person.
You mean kind of like what CMU did to Oklahoma State this week?
That's a good example. It's not. I'm not sure that CMU did it as a drawn up play, or if that's just how it played out, though. I don't know. Andrew, do you think that was a drawn up play?
Right. I think it's a play they had probably practiced just as a late game play. I'm not sure if that's exactly how they drew it up. And that actually, you could call that a hook and ladder, but normally in a hook and ladder, the toss is to an offensive lineman or someone else.
They did actually interview one of the receivers involved in the play who said that he actually blew his route and he was not where he was supposed to be.
Yeah, that sounds more right. Because that one looked a little more chaotic. But the Boise State one, it was planned. It happened right in the middle of the field. It was a perfect pitch. Guy went by completely undefended because everybody was drawn to the first receiver, and that's exactly how the play is supposed to work. Anyway, game goes to overtime. Oklahoma scores on their first drive. So now it's Boise State's ball. Boise State pushes the ball into the end zone, and the coach decides, you know what? I don't need this to go to any extra overtimes. We're just going to go for two. And so they decide. Chris Peterson goes for this crazy play call, which is another one that you hardly ever see. He runs a Statue of Liberty play, which is hard to describe. The quarterback basically fakes a throw and brings the ball down behind his back, and a wide receiver running a jet route will pick up the ball, or jet sweep, my bad, will pick up the ball and then run the ball into the end zone. And the play worked perfectly. Oklahoma wasn't able to defend it. The wide receiver who got the touchdown immediately ran up to his girlfriend, who was a cheerleader, got down on one knee, proposed to her. They are happily married. Boise State won the game. It was ridiculous. Probably one of the best games in college football history. You need to go watch it if you get a chance. To this day, I remember exactly where I was when I saw that. Granted, I was too young to be doing anything exciting, but it was just such a crazy game. In short, overtime games are fun, everybody.
Free football.
Well, it doesn't end. That's my favorite part about college football. You get these crazy 7 overtime games that go past midnight. Like, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, we gotta move on. We gotta start talking about some other stuff. So, like to, as soon as I can find my notes. All right, so I'd like to go ahead and move forward. Andrew, I'm gonna pass it to you as the next part. We're just gonna go ahead and start your fish report.
Well, unfortunately for our man, Fish Smithson, the Kansas Jayhawks were not able to build on their streak-breaking Week 1 win and lost to the Ohio Bobcats this past week. Fish played a pretty good game, 4 solo tackles. He had his first interception of the year, so, you know, congratulations, Fish. And 2 PBUs, which gives him a stat line of the year for 7 solo tackles, 2 assist tackles, an interception, and 3 pass breakups. His brother from another mother, Weston Steelhammer, the safety at Air Force, had 1 solo tackle, 1 assisted tackle, and 2 pass breakups in just a complete and utter demolition of Georgia State. Brings his season up to 3 solo, 3 assist, and 2 pass breakups. You know, some guys to mention. My favorite one so far is Donnell Pumphrey, the running back, 29 carries for 281 yards. That's 9.7 yards per carry and 3 touchdowns. Kalen Ballage, the running back at Arizona State, 13 carries, 137 yards, 7 touchdowns. 2 catches for 48 yards and a touchdown. That man had 8 total touchdowns. You know, a big shout out to James Conner at Pittsburgh, coming back from the injury, coming back from beating cancer, 22 carries and 17 yards and a touchdown against Penn State. You know, that's congratulations to him. Congratulations to Pitt to get that guy back. You know, Rodney Butler, linebacker, New Mexico State, in a thrilling 32-31 victory over in-state rivals New Mexico. You had 4 solo tackles and 20 assisted tackles for 24 total tackles in that game. You know, and then you had some amazing quarterback play this week. You know, Cooper Rush at Central Michigan. Obviously, Lamar Jackson at LSU or Louisville.
Yes, at
and
LSU.
And actually, Danny Etling at LSU played pretty well, too.
I think
– Quinn Flowers at South Florida.
I think LSU wishes they had Lamar Jackson.
You know, they really do. You know, LSU is just one of those teams that you've never been able to figure out why they can't recruit quarterbacks.
So – I might have missed it. Did we already talk about Sunia Totiole?
The defensive back at Utah? No, we did not.
Oh, dude. He had 2 interceptions in the holy war. 41 yards return, and he got a touchdown off that stuff. Man,
I do know that my man Lowell Latulale has been a disappointment at Utah.
It's a sad story. I don't know. Well, I was really expecting a lot out of him this season.
Yeah, me too.
And then another one of my favorite names is the BYU kick returner, Braden El-Bakri. But he only got 13 yards returned, so it's really not worth mentioning. Sorry, dude. But yeah, and I cannot emphasize enough what James Conner returning has done for the Pitt's running back situation. Like, because if you look at they only passed for 91 yards against Penn State. Granted, they got 3 touchdowns through the air, but 341 rushing yards, and how many of those were his? Like, quite a bit, if I remember correctly. Let's see. Well over 100, anyway. Oh, wow. ESPN covers esports now. Oh. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I got distracted. Anybody else got some? Well, with that concluded, unless you got any other names you'd like to bring up, Andrew.
You know, Cade Carney at Wake Forest had a pretty good day, 17 carries for 108 yards and 3 touchdowns, and a big ACC win for the Deacons over the Duke Blue Devils.
Dude, 108.
You know, Mark Walton at Miami had a 4 touchdown game, which is good.
108 yards at Wake Forest makes you a legend, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, it's one of the better games for Wake running back in a while. And like I said, it was a big ACC win for the Deacons.
All right.
Which it's really going to be interesting to see when they play NC State. If they beat NC State, Dave Doran might get fired before that game's over.
I don't know. Not before the Northwestern head coach gets fired.
Nah, Fitzgerald's good. He won 10 games last year.
Well, what if he doesn't win any games this year? All right, anyway, we're moving on. We're going to talk about the stock market now because I know that's where Nigel, you know, fantasizes. Like, he sees all those dollar signs and he just can't help himself. So we had a lot of interesting situations, obviously, this week. We just talked about Northwestern. They're falling apart. They lost to Illinois State, of all people. The Big 12 is taking a sharp nosedive, especially with Oklahoma State losing right after that, on top of Oklahoma last week, and TCU is just falling apart. Tennessee, after kind of dropping last week, has spiked up all of a sudden after they beat Virginia Tech. I think people have kind of forgotten that they even struggled against Appalachian State. And the MAC looks pretty good, aside from their referees. But, Nigel, I'm going to hand it over to you. What are your big buys and sells this week?
While you made a mention of it, Logan, I looked at Northwestern's schedule when, you know, we were talking about, you know, just a little bit earlier, and there's only probably 2 games that I feel that they're going to at least have a shot in, and I'm going to say against Indiana on the 22nd of October and Purdue on the 12th of November. Otherwise, I don't see any teams that they're just going to run over, are basically going to run over them over the rest of the schedule. So they may end up with 2 wins at the most. From there, you know, so I'm definitely not buying any Northwestern stock. Tennessee, I'm going to hold on. I'm not going to make any moves with them. I want to see more. To me, psychologically, I thought they were out of the game after Virginia Tech went up 14-0. But, you know, Virginia Tech basically let them back in the game. So let's see another against a more quality opponent than Virginia Tech, how kind of Tennessee keeps responding if they do get down, if things aren't going their way necessarily. I'm selling all Big 12 stock. Big 12 for me, outside of maybe Texas, and that depends really on what Oklahoma does this week against Ohio State, you know, a top three ranked team. I don't know where the Big 12 is going to go and get their wins. Does Texas have enough notoriety? Are they just such a big name that if they win a couple of games this year, they're going to be in the conversation automatically? I still think they're about a year or two away from contending. So, you know, I'll buy some more Texas stock, but I just, you know, I'm a little iffy. They've won two games, and one of those was, you know, against a Notre Dame team that is, you know, ranked really high, but let's see how they do. But, you know, they've only played one quality opponent. So for me, a lot of buys and holds this week. You know, like I said, Tennessee, let's see. I think they could be magical. I don't want them to be because I have a horse in that race, but we'll see.
Yes, I wouldn't have picked against Tennessee if I remembered my bet with you from last week. So, Tommy, I'm going to pass it to you now. We've got Lamar Jackson, who is probably, like we talked about earlier, the Heisman candidate for September on the rise right now. He's going into a big game against Florida State. So that's a big opportunity for people to either buy or sell their stock while it's high. And then you're also looking at big games. USC going into Stanford. USC stock, after getting clobbered by Bama, is very low. Should people be buying into them going into that game?
If you have any USC stock now, don't even bother selling it. It's not even worth selling anymore. It's already bottomed out. Just hold on to it till next year, and then you'll be able to collect some money on it. Going into the Stanford game, it's just going to go down even further, probably into negative numbers. I don't see them winning that game. As far as Louisville, now's probably a really good time if you've got Lamar Jackson stock to sell it, but as soon as Florida State's over, I'd buy it all back again because I think the Florida State defense is going to give him some fits. He'll get his points. But he's definitely going to take a dip. I think he set expectations too high. Like you said, he scored so many touchdowns that only 13 teams have scored more touchdowns than he has this season. So there's going to be a dip there. So I'd sell it now, buy it back next week, make yourself or short him this week. Make yourself a little bit of gain right there.
Yeah, if you're doing the daily stock trading kind of situation you got going on there. All right. Andrew, Ole Miss is kind of caught in the middle here after their loss to FSU. They're still in the middle ground, but magical things have happened when they faced Bama at home. Well, when they faced Bama in general the past couple weeks. Would you consider buying them, and is there any other stock you're looking for, Andrew?
You know, I don't think now's really time to buy Ole Miss stock. I think Alabama's just that much better than they have been in a long. You know, they're defending national champion. So it's tough to say they're better than they were last year, but I think especially at the quarterback position, they've got a lot more talent than they really had last year, and I think that they've been able to utilize it a lot more. And I think Alabama's going to win that game. You know, I think you should really go out and get Miami or Pitt stock. I think those two teams right now, to me, look like the masters of the coastal. You know, Miami really hadn't played anyone. They go at App, at Georgia Tech, Florida State, and UNC. So that'll really kind of decide their season as to whether or not they're competitors. You know, but Pitt really is the team that's been really impressive to me. They've been balanced on offense. They've had a great defense. Narduzzi's really started to turn that team around. And in my mind, they've got to be the favorite in the coastal. So I think if there's a time to buy Pitt stock, now would be that time.
All right, awesome. So those are your suggestions, guys. I would recommend the Pitt stock. It's about as low as it's going to be for the rest of the season. Anyway, that's going to be the end of our cast for the week two recap. So Thanks for listening, and as always, you can check us out at toemeetsleather.net for more posts and casts. Have a good rest of your night, everybody. Bye-bye.